Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, February 21st. We'll check on these developments around Ukraine to start off today. The Thursday summit with Vladimir Putin that President Biden has agreed to, in principle, they say, as long as Russia hasn't invaded Ukraine by then. There's speculation about why either side would agree to this right now. Is Putin just playing the West, as I heard someone suggest on TV this morning, while he provokes Ukraine into a pretext for an invasion? Or is he more afraid than he admits of Western banking sanctions that would cut off Russian oligarchs' money and turn them against Putin? There's the chilling story, first reported by Foreign Policy magazine, that says Putin has a list of specific Ukrainians to kill, kidnap, torture, or put in detention camps after an invasion. The victims would reportedly include opponents of Russian domination, plus members of ethnic minorities and LGBTQ Ukrainians. The U.S. has reportedly warned the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights about that. And on the larger question of why this is happening at all, the analysis runs from its defensive against NATO. How would we like it if a Russian military alliance wanted to include countries on our border? To Anne Applebaum's provocative new article in The Atlantic, have you seen this, that says the reason Putin is doing this is that he wants democracy to fail, and not just in his own country. Let's talk about this with someone with deep experience covering both the Washington and Moscow sides of it all, Susan Glasser, who writes about Washington for The New Yorker. She spent 4 years of Putin being an apologist. I should say she spent the 4 years of Putin having an apologist in the White House, writing the letter from Trump's Washington column for The New Yorker. And she spent 4 years covering Moscow for The Washington Post. Susan Glasser has also been editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, so that's obviously relevant, and is co-author of the books The Man Who Ran Washington, about former Secretary of State James Baker, who was secretary at the end of the Cold War, and the book Kremlin Rising. Susan, always great to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Why, thank you so much, Brian.
I see you tweeted out the Anne Applebaum article about it being democracy in Ukraine that threatens Putin. How much do you agree with her?
Very much. I mean, look, first of all, Anne is an important and very relevant historian of the region and of Ukraine. And, you know, this obviously has long roots and resonates for a long time. Read her book on the Great Famine created by Stalin in Ukraine, and you'll see. Read, you know, some of what she's written about the Soviet Union in the aftermath of World War II and its efforts to establish control and essentially, you know, dirty war type takeovers of the countries in Eastern Europe after World War II. And a lot of that playbook is still the playbook being used by Russia today and in recent years. So it's very relevant. I think there's been a lot of misinformation, a lot of disinformation. You have political figures in the West, in the United States and in Europe, on both the far right and the far left, who have a real misconceptions about Vladimir Putin and have been amplifying and expanding on a lot of the untrue things that Putin has said about the reason for this manufactured crisis. And again, you know, he created this crisis that we're seeing play out right now to the great tragedy, obviously, potentially of many, many people in Ukraine.
Well, do you think an invasion that destroys democracy in Ukraine has implications for democracy in the U.S. or anywhere else?
Absolutely. You know, I think there have always been people who want to put their heads in the sand at a moment like this. I understand that, you know, in 1940, after Hitler invaded large swaths of Europe, only 7% of Americans wanted to have anything to do with the war. The America First movement existed in one form then. Obviously, the last few years, it's existed in a different form in the United States for some very good reasons. But, you know, this is an effort, a very ambitious effort, not only to change the borders of his own country, Russia, and to take back over a country that has been independent for decades, but also an effort to revise the terms of global security in a way that suggests the U.S. is no longer the paramount power or the guarantor of international stability.
But is that a very 20th century analysis? Like, do you think, or does anybody really think, that Putin wants Russia to march through Europe like they did after World War II, or like the Nazis did before World War II?
Honestly, Brian, I think that's part of our problem, is that we're, you know, so focused on there's either this or there's that, right? Either Putin is trying to restore the Soviet Union or he's just fine. You know, that's just not, you know, that we have so much evidence to suggest for two decades in power, Vladimir Putin has been systematically working first to eliminate democracy inside Russia. And that's the part that I saw in the first 4 years of Putin's tenure, and then to revise the terms of the end of the Cold War, which he views as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the last century. He's working in this century. He's working on hybrid warfare. Whether Americans acknowledge it or not, Vladimir Putin has already attacked the United States. He did that in the 2016 election. And in fact, if you go back and look at the Mueller report, what you see is a very interesting and important timetable that doesn't get a lot of attention, which is that was retaliation from Vladimir Putin for the United States and the Western response of sanctions in response to his first invasion of Ukraine and illegal annexation of territory in the Crimean Peninsula, the first such illegal annexation really since the end of the World War II era. That's what happens when you leave a rampaging bully on the borders of Europe and there's no real resolve and no real sense of what to do about it, right? It's a huge, big problem, and we let it essentially sit there and fester as an open wound.
Susan, this development today of French President Macron apparently brokering this deal for a Biden-Putin summit on Thursday. Biden says it's a deal in principle as long as Russia doesn't invade Ukraine by then. Putin says the summit is not set in stone. What's the gamesmanship, or nicer word, diplomacy there from either side?
You know, I think to call it a certain amount of gamesmanship, certainly it's brinkmanship. We are really in the, you know, as I think it was the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin called it, the snake uncoiling here. The invasion force of something like 190,000 Russian troops, three sides of the Ukraine border, beginning to move over the last few days into attack position. They are stationed literally in forward positions within kilometers of the Ukraine border. They are in forward camps that can't be sustained for a long time. So as the troops move into attack position, you're seeing a sort of end stage public theater today. So last night, basically, French President Emmanuel Macron played this sort of shuttle diplomacy, talking to Putin, then to Biden, then to Putin again. In the middle of the night, Russia time and Europe time, they announced that both sides had agreed in principle to possibly meet each other in person, Biden and Putin, barring an actual invasion. But in principle is doing an incredible amount of work in that statement. And yeah. I think today what we're seeing, I'm following the reports right now of a televised, essentially very theatrical Russian National Security Council meeting with Putin. And I wouldn't bet even a dollar at this point on a Biden-Putin summit occurring.
What's Macron's interest in that? Why is he in this story, brokering this possible summit?
You know, it's very interesting. The French, historically, and that is proven true in this case as well, have taken their own view of foreign policy. And, you know, going back to de Gaulle, and you see that with Emmanuel Macron as well, who, by the way, is up for re-election this year and is playing a certain high-risk game, actually, by inserting himself in a crisis where he may or may not be able to effectuate any positive outcomes. But he, from the beginning, he has been focused on diplomacy with the Russians, flying I think it was 10 days ago to Moscow for the first in-person meeting at the height of this crisis between Putin and a Western leader. So Macron has really, you know, sort of raised his hand to be the kind of intermediary here. But in truth, you know, what we're hearing from American diplomats is that there hasn't been much genuine diplomacy at all. I mean, mostly this has been a story of Putin creating the crisis and moving his invasion force into position. We'll see what he wants to do with it. But, you know, the demands that the Russians have laid down are essentially the type of non-negotiable demands that don't lend themselves to a diplomatic process, right? So it's not like, you know, an arms control treaty and they're just negotiating the terms back and forth. Quite the contrary. There really has been a series of kind of talking past each other interactions that seem part of a choreographed run-up. And because it's Vladimir Putin's play, we can't quite say what the denouement is meant to be.
Jeff in Charleston, South Carolina. You're on WNYC with Susan Glasser from The New Yorker. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, hi. This is me. Your guest's analysis of the situation is so succinct and inarguable that my question is more speculative, if she doesn't mind answering it. If Trump was in the White House at this point, given his disinterest in statesmanship and the international affairs, and at the same time, given what people suspect is his fealty towards Putin, but still having a semi-functioning State Department, what does she think would be happening now if Trump was in the White House as far as a reaction to this international situation?
You know, it's a great question. I'm sitting here in my house working on this book about the Trump presidency with my husband, Peter Baker of The Times, and we had just been talking about that, as you might imagine, and wondering. I mean, first of all, I think it's important to point out that for the entire duration of the Trump presidency, right, you had sort of one on paper policy of the United States and of the State Department toward Russia and Ukraine. And then you had Donald Trump's policy, and they were almost always at odds with each other. The one place where I would say they converged was in Donald Trump's desire to get NATO countries to spend more on defense. And that certainly was also the policy of, you know, the official policy of the U.S. But other than that, you know, when it came to Russia itself and Ukraine, this is a theme that ran through the entire Trump presidency was, you know, Trump actually has said publicly, agreed with Putin that he doesn't really accept the legitimacy of Ukraine as an independent country. He talked about, that Crimea, you know, they really wanted to be Russian anyways. You know, why should we bother about that? When he came into office, he wanted to lift the sanctions that the U.S. and NATO allies had imposed on Russia because of the annexation of Crimea. Of course, he was impeached over his desire at the very beginning of Zelensky's tenure to basically force Zelensky to undertake, personal political investigations that would benefit Donald Trump at the expense of $400 million in U.S. security assistance meant to forestall, by the way, this exact scenario of a Russian invasion. And so, you know, I'm sure Trump would want, on the one hand, to be in the middle of the story, you know, having dramatic last-minute summits. On the other, there's an interesting school of thought that believes that one of the reasons that this is happening right now is that Vladimir Putin, while perhaps appreciating Trump's public compliments toward him, found Trump to be a very unpredictable and potentially dangerous partner, in part because it was clear the U.S. government, the U.S. Congress was not on board with Trump's plans for a kind of pro-Russia accommodation. And so that, you know, for Putin to really revise the international security order requires actually a more stable and predictable U.S. government. So, you know, it's interesting to see this sort of counterfactual argument, but I think it's hard to conceive that we did have a president of the United States who was a sycophant toward Vladimir Putin, but that's the reality.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up. And Jeff, thanks for starting this thread from down there in Charleston. You know, our short memories may not remind us that Ukraine was headline news in this country just 2 years ago when President Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives for threatening Ukraine with lack of military support if they didn't open a fake investigation into Joe Biden. Does anything having to do with that have anything to do with this?
Absolutely. And thank you, Brian, for that question, because I think it's so important. Our narrative about this, Americans tend to look at foreign policy crises as a sort of, to the extent they pay attention at all, as a series of disconnected episodes and incidents. And I think from Putin's perspective, this is one story. And he's been confronting the West, in his view, for decades, but certainly in an active way since 2014 and the takeover of Crimea. You know, these are all just chapters and different, you know, steps along the way in that. And I think if you look at this conflict right now as sort of the culminating chapter as Putin sees it, it looks a lot differently. And, you know, from his narrative that he's constructed, you know, it's about essentially the new president of Ukraine, Zelensky, coming to power in 2019, while Donald Trump is, you know, undertaking essentially a corrupt quid pro quo errand with Zelensky. Vladimir Putin sees Zelensky as coming, you know, saying he's going to sweep out corruption, that he's going to finally make a deal with, you know, make peace with Russia and further pull Ukraine into the Western sphere. And, you know, so I think this is part of one continuous confrontation that Putin sees with the United States.
From a listener on Twitter, it says, Brian Lehrer, are you going to repeat every ridiculous, unsubstantiated propaganda claim about Ukraine coming out of the State Department? Funny how Biden's failures have fallen off the headlines. And the story about Putin getting ready to kill and torture political opponents and LGBTQ people and members of ethnic minorities in Ukraine if he does invade, I am curious if that looks real or fake to you. I mean, that one reminds me of the James Baker era, the Secretary of State, who you wrote a book about from Bush 41. It has the ring of phony stories the U.S. has told to justify past wars, like Iraqi troops pulling babies out. Wait, let me, I'll just finish the question. Pulling babies out of incubators in Kuwait, which made useful headlines just before we went in there, but which I think was debunked. So I'm not saying this is false, but I'm reading that tweet and saying I have a pretty substantial group of listeners who react to stories like that this way. So do you know anything about these new human rights warnings, or how would you put that in context?
I think what your listeners need to understand is that these are not fanciful or academic questions about Vladimir Putin and how he has ruled. These are things that have happened. This is someone who's willing to poison and execute and kill opponents, which he has systematically done not only inside the borders, but outside the borders of Russia. You want to talk about LGBTQ rights? They don't exist inside Russia today. So why would they exist inside of a new Russian territory in Ukraine? This is a country where extrajudicial killings, where rounding up of opponents and the elimination of dissidents has occurred. This is not some fanciful notion. In fact, if Russia is going to invade, and again, this idea that it's sort of made up, you know, I would think that the evidence before people's own eyes of a massive invasion force of 190,000 military troops with incredibly lethal 21st century capacity, you know, would be enough to prove to people this is real. And it's been a very interesting aspect to observe how the U.S. government has had a very different approach than it has to previous conflicts and disagreements with Putin, which is to say being very real-time and transparent in releasing what they believe to be information, in part clearly to shape outcomes and to try to head off the war, or they may simply have believed that it was inevitable that the war was going to take place and therefore best to be, you know, clear along the way. Does that mean that anybody knows with certainty what exactly is going to happen? Clearly not. But I do think it's very, very important to communicate that this is not like some fanciful story about Vladimir Putin and how he governs. There are 22 years of history, well documented. I would point, you know, your readers to any of that to look at what the nature of the Russian regime has been for the last two decades.
Last thing, Susan, we talked about U.S. public opinion. Do you think ordinary Russians are engaged in this drama one way or another? Like, would capturing Ukraine help or hurt the Russian economy as it affects average Russians? Are most Russians invested, as Putin seems to be, in recapturing the glory of empire? Or do they roll their eyes and say, come on, just get me a good job and decent benefits and quality of life? What's the engagement of ordinary Russians, if you can generalize, in this story?
Yeah, you know, Brian, thank you for asking that question. I think it is a really good question. The problem is that, again, after two decades, you have a public media environment in which it's essentially purely propaganda that have been given to the Russian people. And what's interesting is that it's really only in the last week we've seen the stepped up creation of the pretext and the narrative and the drumbeat for war on those Russian propaganda outlets that the Russian people are hearing. So the narrative they're hearing is all about the United States and Ukraine provoking a conflict with Russia. As extraordinary as it might seem to people here in the United States, with the idea that there's, wait a minute, Putin sent this invasion force. The narrative in Moscow isn't about 190,000 troops on the Russian border. It's about the Ukrainians, their Ukrainians, actually somehow provoking Russia. So that's first of all. Second of all, there have been more than a decade of intensive propaganda on the Russian people on the idea that Ukraine and Russia are essentially brothers and never should have been separated in the first place, including the distribution to every member of the Russian military of a pamphlet that Vladimir Putin personally wrote and put his name to last summer, in which he talks about basically goes back into sort of a version of pseudo-history to say that Ukraine doesn't really have the right to exist independently of Russia. So there's been intensive groundwork laid for this. But, you know, the United States and Western allies have promised to have very, very significant sanctions of a level and kind that have just never been imposed before if Russia goes ahead and does this. Obviously, that would create further hardship and difficulties for the Russian people. I think one of the worries is that it might, in a weird way, benefit Putin and the small number of regime insiders who might use that economic suffering of the Russian people to further consolidate their control and power over the country.
Susan Glasser, who writes about Washington for The New Yorker and is co-author of the books The Man Who Ran Washington and Kremlin Rising. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Really appreciate it.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.